G'day, you're listening to a talk given at the Brisbane City Bible Forum. The series is The Heart of the Matter. The speaker is Glenn Hunberg. His talk is titled, Jesus, Liar, Lord or Lunatic? We hope you enjoy the talk.
Well, a few weeks ago, I was on my motorbike, a motorbike, not a scooter, riding out of the city to head home. And I came off Ann Street on the Pacific Motorway in peak hour, and I glanced in my mirror, and behind me, only 3 or 4 metres behind me, was a great big four-wheel drive. Actually, what I could really just see was the grill and the... he backed off a little bit because I think he'd realised how close he was. But then within a few seconds, it was in really quite heavy traffic. Within a few seconds, he surged up very close to me. He was... And this is how it appeared in my mind. He was very close. And he wanted to force me out of the lane so he could go past. I don't know about you, but don't you just hate that when you're the recipient of it? I mean, sure, there was some space in front of me. I was hanging back 2 or 3 seconds in the traffic because I value my life and I don't trust car drivers, no offence. And the traffic was packed across the motorway, across the bridge, and every lane was chockers, including mine, including the one on the right. There was actually nowhere for him to go or for me to go. But he got closer and closer. And I think just because he was so close, you know, he was getting angrier and angrier. And the more resolute I became, although I'm on a small motorcycle, and, you know, your four-wheel drive weighs 2.3 tons and my motorbike, you know, weighs 250 kilos, you will not intimidate me. You cannot force me to change lanes. Now, I admit it, the Christian principle of turn the other cheek had been chucked out of my non-existent window. I was thinking, what are you doing? You've got no right. You've got no authority. You've got no control over me. You can't force me. Anyway, eventually the traffic opened up and I recovered some of my Christian principles and I changed lanes. As he drove past, he yelled abuse at me. And then he kept yelling abuse at me whenever we crossed paths in traffic for the next 3 or 4 kilometres. That's how heavy it was, but that's how long. And that gives you a sense of just how angry he was, but also just how futile. You know what I mean? We just kept crossing over each other. How futile his desire to get past me was. Isn't it interesting how much control and authority matter to us? I think thinking about it's part of one of the reasons for road rage is we actually finally feel like there's something we're in control of, this car. And we can bring our will to bear. And then it's thwarted by motorcyclists who could just ride off and split the lane and get out of my way. We want to be in control. We want to be the authority in our lives. And I think that's actually why the person of Jesus is such a problem for us. Because what we'll hear today, as we hear his words, is his resolute, unreasonable, implacable claim to authority that he will not back down from. And that's what we'll explore. We'll explore Jesus' authority. So we're on to the main point there. And the first thing he really says is that you make false choices. He says, you make false choices. He says this, pick it up at sentence 13. You can see it there. He says, enter through the narrow gate, for wide is the gate and broad is the road that leads to destruction, and many enter through it. But small is the gate and narrow the road that leads to life, and only a few find it. See, we live in a world where choice matters most. My choice, my decision to choose, is essential to my sense of worth and existence. But look what Jesus says. He actually says there's a narrow gate and a wide gate. And the wide is the gate and broad is the road that leads to destruction and many enter through it. He actually says not all choices are good choices. There are false choices. And most people take the false choice. If I picture these, I picture them in mind as two different kind of flows of river. There's the wide, broad, easy river on your left, which, you know, a lot of people could travel down that. You know, you could fit a lot of boats on that. Or the really hard, narrow, difficult creek, the concentration it would require to walk through that with all the boulders and rocks. But the thing is, you know, I know which one I'd rather travel on, right? You know, it's the one on the left. Except the one on the left ends here. It's Niagara River. See the point that Jesus is making? Sentence 13, enter through the narrow gate, for wide is the gate and broad is the road that leads to destruction. And many enter through it. But small is the gate and narrow the road that leads to life, and only a few find it. Now, he doesn't explain what the narrow gate is or what the wide gate is or what the path is. But can you see his implicit claim to authority there? He's saying that not every choice is a good choice. In fact, most choices that we make are bad choices. And when it comes specifically to the area of religion and spirituality, he's saying the right choice is actually very narrow. And implicitly, he's condemning every other choice. He's actually saying there's not many ways to God. There's not a whole lot of choices available to us. There's a narrow gate. Choose that one. One option is life, the other option is death and destruction. But he moves on. He says not only are there false choices, but there's false fruit. Look at the next bit. He says this in sentence 15. Watch out for false prophets. They come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly are ferocious wolves. By their fruit you will recognize them. Do people pick from thorn bushes or figs from thistles? Likewise, every good tree bears good fruit, but a bad tree bears bad fruit. A good tree cannot bear bad fruit, and a bad tree cannot bear good fruit. Pretty simple, right? He's saying people will come. He's using that language of false prophets. So prophets were teachers from the Old Testament Israel. And he's saying they're still coming in the future. And they won't be people who teach the truth. They'll come to you in sheep's clothing, so they'll look like they're part of the flock. They're part of the group. But here he describes them inwardly, they were ferocious wolves. So they've got an external appearance. And what they want to do, they want to eat you alive. They want to devour you, devour your assets, devour your life. Well, how do you pick them out in a lineup of spiritual teachers? I mean, you know, after all, they're wearing a wool blanket. You know, how can you work them out? Well, he says, you know, you can work them out, the good guys from the bad guys, by what their life produces. And so that's the obvious example. See that by their fruit, sentence 16, you will recognize them. Do people pick grapes from thorn bushes or figs from thistles? Maybe we've only got the choice of two different places to get food at the moment. It's Coles and Woolies. So this, you know, it's not a lot of choice there. And both of them provide food. But, you know, in an agrarian culture, you're looking out at a field and you have to choose what you're going to get your food from. And I think just to help us kind of picture this, this is... on the left is a thing called the Bathurst burr. It's a notorious, noxious weed where I grew up in the middle of New South Wales. And, it grows about up to about that high. And it has about a million of those small spike things on them, which are all spiky and painful, protected by those other spikes that are about 2.5 centimetres long. And the one plant will have thousands of them. And so, you know, the obvious thing is you cannot get a strawberry from that. It doesn't matter what you do to it, where you plant it, how much you look after it, it's never going to produce a strawberry. It's a really obvious point. But Jesus sharpens it up. I mean, we kind of get this when it comes to trees and plants. Sentence 18, a good tree cannot bear bad fruit. And a bad tree cannot bear good fruit. The interesting thing is Jesus is actually talking about people. He's talking about people. He's drawing a one-to-one kind of correspondence between what people believe and what they say and what is produced in their lives. And he's saying, you can't break that gap. Between what you believe and what you say, well, actually, maybe just what you believe. You can say all sorts of things. That's an external thing. You can what you believe will lead to action and will lead to your speech. And the fruit will be produced. See that? A good tree cannot bear bad fruit and a bad tree cannot bear good fruit. Let me just make the point by talking about these guys. Anyone know who these guys are? Well done. That's Jimmy and Tammy Faye Baker. Television evangelists from the 1980s, some of the first kind of television evangelists. What did they do? Well, they swindled thousands of gullible Americans. one of the things, one of their scams was, well, I don't, they actually owned a USA theme park called Baker's Heritage. It was actually one of the biggest theme parks in the USA, out of their Praise the Lord Ministries. And they sold lifetime partnerships that promised you lodgings at the Grand Hotel at the Baker's Heritage USA theme park in South Carolina. Well, if you bought up one of their partnerships, and they sold close to 10,000 of those partnerships at that particular point, and you turned up to take up your residence in the Grand Hotel, you had the choice of one of 48 beds in a single bunkhouse. At one point, Jimmy and Tammy Baker paid themselves $3.4 million in bonuses in the 1980s in the US, and they used $250,000 to buy the silence from a young woman by the name of Jessica, who Jimmy had a one-night stand with. And they were running a ministry called Praise the Lord, television evangelists. But eventually, and, you know, they hid all this very well. But in the late 80s, they went to court and were prosecuted for 42 felonies. And I think Jimmy Baker went to jail for 20 years. So you can hide it for a while. But notice again, Jesus' implicit claim to authority here. He's claiming there is truth and there is falsehood. He's saying there is true spirituality that is acceptable and there's false spirituality that's wrong and corrupt. He's saying it's not true that all ways lead to God and that all teaching is acceptable. But more than that, he's saying what is taught and what is believed affects eternity. Look at sentence 19. Every tree that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. And remember, he's talking about people. He's saying a judgment will come. So Jesus claims authority not only over choices, not only over words and the outcome of words, but actually over the whole existence of people. Look at the next bit. I think this is one of the most shocking passages in the New Testament. Sentence 21, Jesus says this, "Not everyone who says to me, 'Lord, Lord,' will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only he who does the will of my Father who's in heaven. Many will say to me on that day," we take it that day is probably the day of judgment or the day of entering heaven, the day of evaluation. "Many will say to me on that day, 'Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name and in your name drive out demons and perform many miracles?'" See, these are people who claim to know Jesus. They called him Lord or Master, and they don't get into heaven. They even carried out spiritual acts in his name. And there's no hint or indication that they didn't carry them out. It seems like they did great acts. They prophesied in Jesus' name. They drove out demons. They performed miracles. It seems like they actually did them. And they call Jesus Lord. They have this. They own him. And what does he say to them? Sentence 23. "Then I will tell them plainly, 'I never knew you. Away from me, you evildoers.'" Isn't that shocking? They were doing not just religious things, but spiritually they were doing the right religious things that corresponded with, you know, Christianity. See, we like to be able to define what is right or wrong, what is good or not good. We sometimes even tell God what that is. But Jesus will have none of that. Even spiritual and miraculous things don't cut it with him. Even things done in Jesus' name don't cut it with him. Notice that that's repeated. In your name we did this. Jesus defines goodness as just one thing. Did you see it there? Sentence 21. "But only he," not everyone who says to me, "Lord, Lord," will enter the kingdom of heaven, "but only he or she who does the will of my Father who's in heaven." Thankfully, he doesn't say not everyone. He doesn't say not anyone who says to me, "Lord, Lord," but not everyone who says. Lots of people say it, but not all of those who say it. He defines goodness according to just one thing: doing God's will. And wickedness is anything else. It's an incredible claim to authority. He's saying he's the determiner of true spiritual acts. He's the determiner of life. On Judgment Day, he's the one who says who gets into heaven and who doesn't. And he says, even if you in some sense, he's saying you can't earn it. Because he says, even if you do miraculous things, that might not be good enough. So in some sense, he's saying you can't actually earn it. He says, I never knew you. That's key. I never knew you. But, see, if that's not enough, Jesus' audacity is shown in this last part. And I think these are some of Jesus' most revolutionary words. Sentence 24. This is how he ends the Sermon on the Mount. Therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and puts them into practice is like a wise man who built his house on the rock. The rain came down, the streams rose, the winds blew and beat against that house. Yet it did not fall because it had its foundation on the rock. But everyone who hears these words of mine and does not put them into practice is like a foolish man who built his house on the sand. The rain came down, the streams rose, the winds blew and beat against that house, and it fell with a great crash. Picture two houses. Both constructed the same. Both, you know, brick veneer, tile roofs, same cladding. There's nothing really different about them. It's the foundation that makes the difference. Jesus picturing, you saw it there, sentence 25. He says, and yet it did not fall. The rain came down, the stream rose. It did not fall because it had its foundation on the rock. And the other one had its foundation on the sand. So there's nothing in the house construction that made a critical difference, nothing in the labour involved, nothing in the expense, just one thing, the foundation. And what is that foundation? Sentence 24, therefore everyone who hears these words of mine and puts them into practice is like a wise man who built his house on the rock. Or sentence 26, but everyone who hears these words of mine and does not put them into practice. Jesus is saying the foundation are his words. See, it seems to me that many of our lives look the same. We were born and raised. We were institutionalized at some point in school, and we somehow survived. We were persuaded somewhere along the way that work matters and making ends meet matter. We slog away to earn a crust. Family and friends and work colleagues matter to us, even when they cause us pain. We quietly hope, or this might just be me, but we quietly hope that our hobby might somehow become a full-time occupation that we could earn a living from, even if it is croqueting. Just, you know, could there be another way to earn a crust? Our lives look the same. At one level, the lives of those that follow Jesus and those that don't look pretty much the same, except when the storm comes. And that's Jesus' point here. When the storm of death and judgment come, one life will stand and another life will be brought down. Why? Because one life was better than another? Because one life was full of more good deeds than another? Because one life was a church-going life and another wasn't? Because one life had miraculous prophecies in it? No, one reason. Because one life had Jesus' words as its foundation, while the other life ignored Jesus and his words. Doesn't that strike you as unreasonable? Doesn't Jesus just sound like a really unreasonable guy at this point in time? I mean, reasonable people, they compromise. They make deals. They give space to breathe. But Jesus won't have a bar of it. Not at all. He's so unreasonable. He's so unreasonable, I think we've got three options when we come to him. He's either a lunatic, or a liar, or he's Lord. Now, C.S. Lewis used those phrases, and it's worth chasing him down, an English writer from 50 or 60 years ago. I'm going to steal them and use them. So he's either a lunatic. I actually prefer to call this the melon head option. It's not staying. There it is. It's the lunatic option. He's just a melon head. He's got no idea how to conduct himself in the real world. This is actually an Australian phenomenon. I was having a barbecue with some English people, and they said to me, what is it with the marrows on the head? And I said, what? They said, the marrows. Why do you Australians put marrows on your head? I was a bit flabbergasted. I didn't have an answer for it. I had nothing. See, that's one of our options for Jesus. He just doesn't know what he's talking about. And that's actually what the people who lived at Jesus' time debated at various points. Some of them, when they heard Jesus speak, said he's stark raving mad. It's actually recorded in the New Testament for us. Jesus is actually stark raving mad. But other people responded and said, look at his words and his deeds. Does someone who's demon-possessed or someone who's mad do these things? And what they're pointing to is just the deep coherence in what Jesus said. When you take the biographies, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John about Jesus, historians don't treat them as one, or the Bible as one book, or don't treat the New Testament, even Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John, as four historical sources. They actually see them as made up as multiple historical sources. So you've actually got 8 or 9 historical sources when you come to look at Matthew, Mark, and Luke, John. And even non-Christian historians recognize the deep coherence in what Jesus said from those 8 or 9 different historic... It's under debate how many there are, but there's that many. And they say they accept Jesus' coherence. And if Jesus was a lunatic, it just doesn't make sense. Surely the 12 men and the women who followed him around for 3 years would have spotted the madness in that time, unless they were all deluded as well. Now, I mean, Jesus being a lunatic, treating the New Testament not as a religious text, but as a historical text, and Jesus a historical figure, just doesn't do justice to that historical evidence that we've got. So what about the liar option? Was Jesus a liar? Well, I think this is an option that I think liar doesn't capture it, because listen to his words. Jesus said, sentence 24, everyone who hears these words of mine and puts them into practice is like a wise man who builds his house on the rock. So he's saying you listen to his words and you'll survive death, you'll survive destruction, you'll survive judgment day. And anyone who doesn't listen to my words and obey them will face death and face destruction and face God in judgment. He says heaven and hell hinge on his words. So if he's a liar, I mean, that just doesn't capture it. He's a megalomaniac. Because he's saying I, and what I say ought to be at the center of your existence. Earlier on in Matthew's Gospel, in the start of the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says this right at the beginning. He said, blessed are you. He says, good times, great joy to you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. I mean, that's megalomania. That's one of the options. Jesus expects and demands that people put him at the center of their lives. He's just completely unreasonable. Unless, of course, he's Lord. And that's the final option. This thing is really not working well for me. See, that's the other option, that Jesus is actually Lord, Master, Ruler of the universe. He's the one who rules. And that's his assumption throughout the Sermon on the Mount. Again and again, Jesus would say, you have heard it said, but I tell you. You've heard people debate this, even religious people, but I say to you. You think this is how to live? I'm telling you that's not the way to live. Let me see if I can try and explain how Jesus sees himself and what he's doing for us here. I had a Boost juice cup on my desk, which I left behind, hence the image, right? You'll have to work with me. If this is us, when people think about the Christian life, they think about it as the wide rim here, and it's all sorts of things. It's going to church, it's reading the Bible, it's being good, it's having forgiveness, it's grace, it's mercy, and so it's all these things. But what Jesus is doing in the Sermon on the Mount is defining Christianity as just one thing, this end, turning around and saying, if this is us, you have to bow down to get through this gap and accept my authority. You have to accept my word. You have to see my word as the center of your life and existence. And then you enter into the Christian life. But there's no other way in except through this. And that's what Jesus is saying for us here. And he's claiming in that, once again, his lordship, his authority to say this is what it must be like. Not this is what it could be like, or how you should consider it being like. This is what it must be like. Jesus is saying this is what defines being a Christian, someone who accepts his authority, and that anything less is not Christianity. So who's control and who's authority? Jesus, that's what he drives to in the Sermon on the Mount. And that's hard for us. That's really hard for us. We hate when people exercise authority over us, even when it's rightful authority. You know when you've done something and your manager gives you a rebuke and they're in the right? We hate it. Even if they're in the right, we hate someone exercising authority over us. And I think that's people, but that's Australians as well, in particular. There's a reason that we've stayed a state and island. They've got all these people who hate authority all over here. But that's what Jesus demands for those who call themselves Christian. And that's what Jesus confronts us with if we are to come to him. He's unreasonable. He won't let us just say, this is a good man. Or this is a spiritual teacher who we can learn from. No, he's unreasonable. He says, no, accept my authority or I'll have nothing to do with you.